This is The Big Web Show, a live talk show about the web and the future of web publishing. The Big Web Show is sponsored by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. MailChimp serves more than 300,000 users and 20 million emails daily, and their template language makes it dead simple to code HTML email that gives your clients the ability to adjust colors, fonts, and more without breaking the layout or having to mess with your code. Sign up free and see why everyone's switching to MailChimp. Check them out at MailChimp.com. This is episode number 9 of The Big Web Show. I'm Dan Benjamin, joined as always by my co-host, Jeffrey Zeldman. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hello, Dan.
Perhaps you could do the kindness of introducing our extra special guest today.
It will be my pleasure. Today we have with us Ethan Marcotte, designer, developer, writer, bon vivant, man about town. He has written for, he's written for New Writers. He's written, he's contributed to handcrafted CSS, Web Standards Creativity. He's co-author of Handcrafted CSS with Dan Cederholm and co-author of Designing with Web Standards, third edition, with me. He's a really fine designer, loves knockout. He's one of those
I don't have a problem.
he's one of those hybrid designer developer types that we love so much. And he's actually about to sign a contract to write a new book on responsive web design, which is the name of a technique which of designing websites so that they work in multiple platforms. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that and much else as the show progresses. He's also a heck of a nice guy. And Ethan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me, guys. It's really an honor to be here.
No, it's our honor. Great to have you here. I just want to jump in and say, before we do anything, this is huge, what you've done with this responsive web design thing. I didn't really appreciate it until I read the A List Apart article and saw the example that you did, and then even more recently saw the John Hixory design, which we'll talk about. But I just want to say, get on the record here and say, you're going to be seeing a lot of this coming up. So this is big, what you've done here.
And the Simon Collison redesign.
Yes.
Which is the one that really, and Hix is great, but Collison was the one where I went, oh! You know, and I knew when Ethan came up with the idea that it was a great idea, but when I saw the website of Mr. Simon Collison, and I mean, for people who have, well, what's the URL?
I'm showing them right now. It's collie.com, C-O-L-L-Y.com.
Yeah, and so basically it's a series of, for those who are just listening, it's like a series of odd playing cards or odd collectible cards, almost like bubblegum cards. Not that, though. The homepage is laid out with these cards, and each card represents a topic area. And initially, there's an 8x8 or a 6x6 grid, but basically, you can resize it down to a 1x1 grid. So, yeah. Whether you've got the first iPhone, or you're looking at it on an iPad, or you're looking at it on a gigantic monitor that's very high resolution, whatever you're looking at it, it reflows. Well, Ethan, maybe you should explain, since this is your baby, what exactly
I don't know if it's my baby, but the name definitely is. It's a lot of different technologies that have been around for a while that I think we can start finally getting out of this zero-sum game, I think, of designing a different experience for different devices, different browsers, and come up with layouts that kind of really respond kind of intuitively to the context the user's sitting in. The thing I love about John Hix's site is that he's working with a flexible grid, which I think is one of the first ingredients you need for a responsive design. And, in and of its own right, it's perfectly flexible, but if he sort of ended there, it probably wouldn't scale well beyond the desktop. So he's introduced media queries to kind of come up with some, I guess, contingency designs for different resolution ranges. So as you are viewing this on an iPhone or on an HTC phone or what have you, I mean, the grid kind of redefines itself and optimizes itself responsively. And I think it's just gorgeous. Both he and Simon Collison did a really, really great job with their sites. I hope it's going to be a big year for this, but it feels exciting. So
just as an example, if you look at hicksdesign.co.uk/journal,
/design,
that's HICKS design, hicksdesign.co.uk/journal. I mean, if you start by dragging the bottom right edge of the browser to the narrowest point, you basically have a beautiful phone-style single-column layout that looks very attractive. It seems perfectly well-designed for that environment. If you stretch a little more, you get a two-column layout. And if you stretch a little more, you get a three-column layout. And if you stretch basically to fill up a giant IMAX screen, you get a four-column layout. And after that, it becomes centered and there's white space and everything's beautiful. But so...
Yeah.
Basically, just about anything you can throw at this, it looks like it was designed for that. And maybe you can explain what media queries are and why we can use them now and how long they've been around, all that good stuff.
Yeah, sure. So media queries are part of the CSS3 specification, and they're kind of like the old concept of media types, you know, when we design a print-only style sheet, but they're sort of on steroids. So we can specify a class of device like print or screen like we used to, but also actually sort of inspect the kind of the physical characteristics of the device that actually is rendering our content. You know, this could be anything from aspect ratio. You know, if I'm viewing this on, say, like a high-definition television or on a cinema display versus like a 4x3 television. Let's say I'm using a console browser. Media queries just sort of let us... you know, just sort of optimize our content for different displays. And I think they tie in nicely to this whole idea of being responsive in that, you know, we don't necessarily need to think about quarantining our content on different URLs or, you know, redirecting people kind of depending on what their browser's user agent string is. We can just sort of like create this kind of like gradient of an experience across different resolutions. So that's what's kind of exciting to me about this is we can stop sort of playing this. Yeah. Sorry?
In English. I just want to put that in English for some people. No, I think you expressed it beautifully, but a little bit technically. So I just wanted to say, for instance, you might not need to do mobile.yoursite.com. You might not need to make a mobile version of the site. You could just have a really, you know, assuming a baseline of smartphones, right? Because there is probably a bottom edge to it. It's not just lowest common denominator forever. I mean, I think if you have some old clamshell phone from 10 years ago that has a text web browser, we're not talking about designing for that.
Right. And I think that was sort of one of the things that started off this thinking about, you know, becoming more responsive is somebody actually posted a link to an article. A friend of mine posted a link to an article on Twitter and, you know, it was short. And so I clicked on it and it was actually, it lived on a WebKit subdomain. So it was like webkit.cnn.com or something. And I'm sitting at my desktop, you know, on a cinema display. And so I've got like a line that starts here, you know, going all the way out to, you know, over here. So I think that, you know, there are definitely business cases where I think it's still probably valuable to start thinking about, okay, well, maybe this audience needs to see this subset of my content. But, I think that media queries sort of allow us a different alternative, maybe more powerful.
So just to follow up on your example, let's say I went to, currently, if I'm on my iPhone and I go to mobile.newyorktimes.com, I see a special presentation that's optimized for a narrow screen, and I say, wow, this is a really terrific article. I'd like to let my friend know about it. So I send that article to a friend, and she opens it up on her gigantic 32-inch screen, and she's looking at this mobile design that's, you know, sort of like this little bacon strip, on this giant piece of white. So that's not good. But if instead of a mobile site, they just used media queries, then I would have a really good experience reading the site, and it would look like the New York Times. It would be branded like the New York Times. So with media queries, can you, and with... responsive design, can you also hide some of the images that are inappropriate or too big? I mean, can you say a device this small probably has limited bandwidth, so I don't want to show it? I mean, all the rationales for having a mobile site make sense. Those are legitimate rationales. Can we accommodate those with responsive design? Can I say, I don't want this big picture of a pipe, or I don't want this gigantic background image. I'll take that out of the CSS for... Mm-hmm. You can do all that, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's just like when we were creating print style sheets again. You know, you can sort of think about what kind of content is most sort of suitable for that particular medium, and then sort of suppress its display. And actually, I know you guys had Luke W. on the show a couple weeks ago. I mean, if you sort of take his concept of starting with mobile first, I mean, if that's going to be a huge part of your audience, the first part of being responsive, I think, is like you start with a reference resolution. You know, this is where I think most of my users are going to be reading this content. Maybe that's the desktop, or maybe in Luke W.'s case, it's, you know, starting on the cell phone. If you're really concerned about bandwidth, maybe starting small and then scaling up progressively really makes the most sense. Yeah, so I think there are different ways you can do it. Media queries can definitely help with that.
You're writing a book for A Book Apart. On responsive web design. What I mean, you've already given us the article, and that was a page. Right. So, what else is there to know? What's going to go into a book?
Yeah, that's well, we're still working on that. But
well, we love the outline that you.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great.
It's always nice to tell you that in front of an audience. But we love the. Yeah. We're ready to send you a contract. We're like full speed ahead.
Yeah. So there we awesome. Go. Well, I think, so as I said in the ALA article, and I think the book's going to have to cover some of this, is that, you know, what we're calling responsive web design starts with a flexible grid, fluid images kind of peppered throughout, and then media queries to kind of spot check display errors as they sort of pop up and kind of like optimize your content, you know, for the reading experience of a different device or context. I think taking a step beyond that, I think there are a couple challenges that still need to be thought through. One is, you know, there are a lot of really common sort of like desktop design patterns that I think we rely on a daily basis, like, you know, tab modules or photo slideshows, and thinking about ways that we can sort of adapt and streamline those experiences for different contexts is, I think, one of the large things that the book's going to deal with. Because the layout thing, I think, feels like the easy part to me, and some of the detail work is where I think... that's where a lot of the exciting stuff is going to be.
Ethan, I've got a question for you.
Sure.
And this kind of echoes what some of the people are saying in the chat room right now.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they're talking about the design approach that you take for something like this. They're talking about it potentially adding some complexity. The question that I have that instantly occurs to me is, if you're doing this for yourself, or for, it may be a little bit different, but typically, yep, and although I think this is changing, typically the design process most often is the designer builds something cool in Photoshop and sends that comp over to the client. The client looks at it and says yes, or make these changes, or whatever. Does this change your approach? Does this change the way that you might do those initial comps? Do you want to start in HTML and CSS like a current movement? What's the take on that? How does the actual process change when you're building a site like this from the get-go?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I think I will say that most of the sort of like responsive layouts that I've built, you know, I'll mock up that initial sort of like reference point, the kind of the ideal display in Photoshop, and still work with the client to get approval on that. But most of the responsive stuff has been designed in the browser for the most part, because I'm sort of either adapting assets that already live in the page, or, you know, maybe just streamlining content or suppressing elements. So I really think that, you know, maybe it's a hybrid. You know, maybe we sort of manage things kind of traditionally up to a point, and then we really start reviewing things kind of in the browser.
You're pretty familiar with Andy Clark does this. Andy Clark makes different layouts depending on what the device that's looking at it is capable of seeing, right? He's talked about that. And he's also talked about designing in the browser. And he's not just talking about, you know, blog layouts. He's talking about really artistic creative layouts.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll say that, you know, up until I started really playing around with this stuff, I'd always been kind of in the more traditional camp. You know, you know, I'd never touch HTML and CSS until like I got all the design ideas kind of, I guess, out on the page.
Sure.
So yeah, but I think there's definitely there's going to have to be more, I guess, work done kind of live, I guess, because you're really not going to get a sense of sort of like how something feels in a mobile context without that sort of like prototype touch point. So yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not really much of a project manager, but that's kind of my best guess.
What's on the Hicks redesign? What's going on with the? He's got these little images in the sidebar.
Oh.
But if you are only looking at it as a one column layout, those little images get huge. How's he doing that?
Let's see here.
If you go to the bottom, right. So in the sidebar, there's all these little like playlist images for music that he likes. But if you go down to one column, those playlist images become huge. Like they would be primary, they become primary content in a in an iPhone.
Yeah, I love how that's awesome.
How so is he doing that?
Well, I'm just looking at the CSS now, but the
don't put him on the spot or anything.
What I mean is,
how are you doing it? Analyze the CSS and code immediately and tell us exactly what he's. No, I see, and I'm showing it to the audience too. It's in this little section at the bottom, and when you go down to one column, they get really big, and then when you get to the other columns, they become smaller elements in the sidebar, and then when you stretch again, they become even smaller in the second column. So it's kind of fascinating. And doesn't this offer a handful of different ways to provide content to people, not just based on their platform, but based on other things and the way that they may interact with the browser?
Yeah, it almost seems like you could do content strategy per device and still have one layout, one design, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty exciting stuff. So what John's doing is he's actually doing a couple different things. He's sized the images larger than they kind of appear in the default design, the sort of more desktop-oriented design. And then at the smaller resolution, he's actually using CSS to kind of upscale them slightly. So they become those like really nice, kind of satisfying Fisher-Price looking things. You know, they just feel kind of tactile. So yeah, this is again like this is sort of an example of the mobile first mentality. You know, maybe he when he got down to this point, he realized that you know, hey, I'd really like these to kind of dominate the page. So he kind of adapted accordingly. And I realize I just spoke for John, but that's just my best guess.
See, you said don't put him on the spot, but I work with Ethan, and you can ask Ethan crazy questions like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he had a pretty darn good answer too, didn't he?
Can just you've been viewing Source for a long time, my friend.
Yeah, Firebug is my friend. That's all.
You know, something that occurred to me. I mentioned to this to Ethan about this earlier, and I'm curious to see if you have any thoughts on this. How, you know, I'm not really a designer, and I think there are a lot of people out there who are not designers who muddle through decent design. They copy people. They steal a lot of good code. This isn't the kind of thing that you can just look at and unless you're you or unless you're a pretty talented, competent CSS type person. Mm-hmm. You know, as a developer, as an amateur designer, this seems almost unapproachable in a way.
Right.
Does that make sense? It seems like it's something that's just tough to do. How do you wrap your head around this, first of all, and then second of all, how do you start to integrate this? When do you want to do this, and what kind of sites would this be right for? Is this the right technique for every single site?
Yeah, there's a lot of great questions there. I think in terms of the accessibility, the whole idea, I think I do wonder, like, again, designing in the browser can really help with some of that. The exciting thing about this is that it feels like we've got a lot of the building blocks already there. We've been preaching about the separation of content from presentation for years now.
Right.
And, you know, so if you've got a logical source order, you know, you're already sort of halfway there to kind of thinking about how to optimize it for different displays. So, like, again, not to keep harping on John's site, but, you know, when you get down to a certain point, his brand and his primary navigation, they move from the right margin right up to the top of the page. And he's thought about how his HTML needs to be ordered to do that. So I think if you're thinking about web standards in general, and, you know, so practicing a lot of the best practices that we've been talking about for years, then you know, you might be a little in better shape to start thinking about, okay, well, now I can use media queries to sort of adapt, I guess, to respond to the different contexts. So that's, I guess, yeah, that'd be sort of my guess.
What happens in IE9?
Well, IE9, that's what's kind of exciting is that they've actually committed to supporting media queries. And the sort of first two ingredients of being responsive, as I said in the article, are, you know, a fluid grid and flexible images. Those work in IE today. So we can start preparing for this now. And then there's some JavaScript patches to kind of like bridge the gap between the current IE that we're dealing with and IE9 in the future.
Well, actually, have you looked at IE9 yet?
No, I mean, I've been following it kind of closely, but I keep getting asked if I've looked at IE9 yet, and I need to install it at some point. But yeah, no, I haven't checked it out, but it seems like from what I've heard from like Andy Clark and the press releases they've been putting out, it seems like they're actually incorporating a lot of really great stuff.
At what point though, Ethan, and Jeffrey too, at what point does it become unreasonable for the designer to be expected to test on all of these different browsers and all of these different platforms? I mean, new browsers are coming out all the time, new versions of browsers. You know, just when we said, okay, things are going to get simpler and better, they just continue to get more and more difficult.
That's not really true. We got Firefox, which is Gecko.
Right.
We got WebKit, and we've got IE.
And that's it. We don't have to worry about...
WebKit is Chrome, and I mean, there is a fork in WebKit because Chrome, you know, at some there are differences between Chrome and Safari, but so yeah. And then there's Opera.
There's Opera, but yeah. There's also the
Poland.
There's also the mobile platforms. You've got different browsers on Android. Right, you've got browsers on, you know, I mean, technically, yeah, it's probably the same browser behind the scenes on the iPad and the new iPhone, but there are some differences, and obviously screen resolution is important. I mean, do you need to have every single device and every single main browser out there to really get an idea of what the experience is in these? Is that just part of your toolkit now as a designer?
I think if you design with standards and you don't expect the site to look the same in every device, then you're in pretty good shape. Just a couple, you know, unless you make an SVG version of your web fonts, you won't have web fonts in iTunes. I mean, in the iPhone. And right. That's okay, right? You can decide, I want SVG. It's worth the trade-off to me and use SVG. Or you can say, I'm not going to use SVG and I don't care. And they can look at Georgia and it'll be fine. And, you know,
right.
The mobile WebKit does things like it... it boosts the default font size so that it looks good on an iPhone. So the result is, if you, like me, if your opening paragraph at Zelman.com, right, the opening paragraph is larger because it's an introductory paragraph. It's larger than the rest of the text, except not on an iPhone. On an iPhone, everything's the same size because Apple boosts the base size. And I could, you know, spend a lot of time trying to work out a way to make the fonts even bigger on the iPhone in the first paragraph. It's, you know, who cares? It's fine. You know, the right. Little effect is missing. So what? I think a lot of us are coming around to the idea that, like, you know, progressive enhancement works both ways. And I think people are becoming more accustomed to seeing websites look different in different devices anyway. And that's helping us, you know, that's helping us get rid of the, Ethan, in the, how do you still hear constantly from clients, it has to look the same in every browser? I don't hear that anymore.
Yeah, not so much anymore. But, you know, we are starting to hear, you know, and this is sort of what kicked off the responsive web design article was, you know, people are starting to ask for an iPhone website by name. So, you know, people are starting to think about, you know, moving beyond the desktop. But I definitely agree with you that I think progressive enhancement can definitely get us most of the way there. And maybe this is sort of a point too for doing sort of like live design reviews in the browser, like Andy Clark said. You know, so rather than going through like a full creative review of what the iPhone design is going to look like, you know, maybe the mobile experience needs to be tested live by the client. So then, you know, it kind of degrades naturally as they bring it up. So they're they kind of have an expectation of what the design is going to be when it's final. Yeah, but the nice thing about
sorry.
No, I was just going to say the nice thing that I've found working with media queries and trying to do this whole responsive thing is that it's actually pretty easy for me to sort of like snap in a new fix for something or to kind of optimize for a new device, just because we're really talking about, you know, maybe a handful of rules to kind of like streamline elements or to kind of like optimize maybe the measure of a line in a particular device. You know, because we've still got this full reference design kind of working in the browser already, and we're just sort of like, I guess, streamlining it a little bit.
Greg Story makes the comment back to when I said, are we required to make a different version that works in everything? And he makes a good point. He says, well, if that's what you promise the client, then yes. And that goes back to your comment before that Ethan, that you're hearing a lot of clients or customers saying, yeah, we want an iPhone version. But I believe that it's a nice thing that Apple's done in giving us a relatively consistent browser across the iPhone, the iPad, and the Mac. And I think when other browsers start to try to catch up to that, the ones that aren't there yet, we'll be able to give that much more standard experience. But do you find in the work that you do now that your mentality is changing, that in the back of your mind you can't just sit down and do a simple design? Like when you look at your own site, Unstoppable Robot Ninja, do you look at that and say, yeah, that looks fine on the iPhone, the iPad, or do you think, I really want to apply this technique and this technology to that design? Do you want to now go back and retrofit everything that you're doing?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I should point out the design of my blog is definitely like about a year old or so, and it's using some of the early design principles that were coming out when the iPhone was really getting some traction. So, you know, below a certain resolution range, I'm just dropping in a mobile style sheet, and it's kind of limited to mobile. And beyond a certain point, you know, the grid is just kind of static. It's flexible, but it doesn't really sort of like reorient itself for like a widescreen display. So I definitely, this feels like the new exciting thing that we can start playing with is, you know, starting to rethink about what is the best way to design for not just a fixed minimum screen resolution, but, you know, any sort of like reading experience. You know, what does that look like? So yeah, I definitely want to go back and fix everything.
Dan Brady asks, I love the Hicks design. However, the initial page weight, and I haven't qualified this, but he says the initial page weight is nearly 6 megabytes. I don't think that could be right. He says,
just the CSS.
Yeah. He says, will phones not download images with display none? And that's another thing when you think about this, if you are creating images that need to be much, much larger in the case of a large view, aren't you also pushing a lot of that down to the smaller clients unnecessarily? Aren't you sending a lot more data than you would need to? And won't that slow rendering time and change the experience, even though it's better visually? Mm-hmm. Are you changing the overall experience by slowing things down for other platforms?
Yeah, that's definitely a concern. And again, I think it really depends on where your reference point is. You know, beyond a certain point, you know, maybe it does make sense to direct mobile users, especially if you know bandwidth is going to be an issue, to a separate URL. Where I think this really works well is, again, if you want to design for mobile first, there's nothing to sort of prevent you from making that your default resolution and then using media queries to kind of scale up and give that sort of like fully featured version. But even if you start with desktop and then scale down in your media queries, you know, if you're hiding elements, if you're say removing like heavy backgrounds, those rules should essentially just overwrite any previous properties you've written in your CSS. So
interesting.
Yeah, hopefully that should.
The person shouldn't be downloading it. If it's hidden, they don't have to download it.
Background property. I know, for example. So if your background is awesomely huge .png by default, and then in a separate media query you're overwriting that, then yeah, they should be spared the download. I should probably state right now, like, I'm not a mobile optimization expert, but one person I've been looking to a lot for reading up on this is PPK, who writes at quirksmode.org, and he's written some incredibly great articles lately about designing for different viewports, and just came out with a new entry in that series yesterday, which is worth checking out. So, yeah, sorry to punt on the question, but I'm still learning a lot about this.
No, that's we're getting some
quirksmode.org.
Quirksmode.org. We're getting some people in the chat room now who are telling us that it's about 4.4 megs in size, the Hicks design, which is big, especially if you're pushing it out over a mobile a mobile device. There's another question. Is there a point when you're building a site where you do this new exciting stuff with HTML5, JavaScript, CSS3, but then you need to back off because it's too CPU intensive? I mean, we talked about bandwidth. Are you thinking about CPU at all? Are you thinking about whether you're taxing some of these smaller devices, or is that just...
That's a good question. I think that's one of those things where you really have to... That's where testing becomes a necessity. I think at some point, you really need to vet kind of your expectations for how this is going to work. Again, I'm designing most of my responsive designs in a desktop browser, so at some point I need to pick up a phone or an iPad and actually see how it feels. Because you definitely can't do this stuff in isolation. I think you need to, again, it's supposed to feel responsive as well as act responsive. So
there's a New York Times iPhone app, which I generally don't use. I generally use m.nytimes.com because it's more responsive, faster. Right. But if this app, a couple of things the app does very well. The app doesn't really just gives you the content and a photo, and it lets you bookmark it in Twitter or send it to a friend or bookmark it in Facebook, and it uses they kind of have their own hand rolled URL shortener, right? It's ny.ms or something.
Right.
That URL shortener will send me, if I'm at a desktop browser, to the actual desktop page, right? So, and it'll send me to the mobile site if I'm on a mobile device. So anyway, there are times when when a mobile application actually seems like a good idea. This isn't for everything. So maybe in the book you'll want to address which is better and what setting. I may have picked a terrible example. Maybe a responsive design would still be the best. But in terms of not wanting to download a lot of high bandwidth stuff if I just want to get the news headlines.
Right.
Now, Jaspio asks a question before you hit that one. I don't want to lose this one. Jaspio says, if pages become heavier again, won't you shoot yourself in the foot as for how Google is measuring page speed? And there was, for those who haven't been following this, Google recently came out and said that now the way that we're going to be handling things like search ranking isn't just going to be based on terms and our old algorithm. We're now integrating how fast a page responds, and in many cases that comes down to how big the page is, and Google is checking for that. So is this a good thing or a bad thing? Does this support the older mentality of detect what browser they're using and send them something different if they're mobile, as opposed to trying to build one design like this that responds to that? Does that?
I'm going to go to Mr. Hicks's defense and say this is one of the first sites to do this, and it may not be perfectly optimized yet. Think of this as a beta. He's saying, look at this. I've finally done this. Isn't it nice?
And we're all going, wow, for the record, I'll jump on that and say, I think it's worth it. I think the extra bandwidth is worth it. I think John has created one of the most amazing websites that I've seen in a long time when it comes to responding this way. I think it's really, really cool. All of the sites that we've been talking about today are outstanding. I think it's worth it. I think we need to start dealing with a lot more bandwidth. I mean, if you go to 5x5, I've got, I've got tons of flash and other things there that you can't even download unless you have a really good connection. So I'm all for sending more data, but I just want to say there's got to be, if you decide to do this, you have to say, well, what are the consequences of doing that?
All I want to say is that I'm pretty sure that John Hicks is working on the site and that it won't be 4 megs. It won't be a 4 meg homepage for long, if it really is now. I think there's also, I don't remember the, I think some of the tools that tell us how much bandwidth is being used are inaccurate in that they download things that you aren't necessarily even using yet, right?
Right.
So, So they may download like every version of a web font, even though on the page that you're on, just as an example, they don't subset the web fonts. They download everything, right? Or they measure everything. So it may be that it's looking at the whole site.
And right. It may be. But I'll go back and I'll say it's worth it. I think creating this kind of experience comes at a slight cost. And yeah, John's working on it. But look what he's been able to do. This is really awesome.
Well, I can't do that, but I can put a MIDI file on my site.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, Dan. I think, you know, ultimately it comes down to what not only your users can kind of support, but what you as a business can kind of support. Because at some point, we all realized that, hey, you know, creating a separate print-only version of every page on your site was just kind of, you know, it's unmaintainable for some companies.
Right.
You know, so that was kind of like the powerful business case for, you know, we can design a style sheet just for that experience. So again, you know, maybe there are going to be perfectly good reasons where you're going to want to conserve bandwidth and it's going to be almost critical to have things on a separate URL. But I do wonder if, you know, we've just sort of made that our default and maybe we just sort of need to start questioning that a little bit. Anyway, that's my thought.
Yeah, I mean, CSS Zen Garden isn't always like bandwidth friendly, right? But there's a reason for that. There's a justification for that. So I guess like with everything else in web design, the answer is it depends, right? In a perfect world, you will optimize the heck out of what you're designing so that, you know, it's as light as possible for everyone, but with no sacrifice of rich experience.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well, indeed. I think, you know, one of the things that also occurs to me after looking at this is that, you know, this might be something that you would use on certain kinds of sites. For other sites, you might still want to use a fallback kind of a technology. And again, I think John knows his audience. I think he knows there's a lot of designers, developers that are going to come and look at this. Yeah. He's not serving up a million page views a day the way the New York Times is or the way USA Today is or whatever. And I think knowing and understanding your audience, which John does, that's who you should be designing for. That's the correct way, I think, to design is you know your audience, you know what they expect and what you want to deliver to them. And that's the kind of experience you should focus on and create.
Yeah,
several people in the chat room are talking about vectors. And I think with SVG, the more we can do if we have browser support of SVG, that's another good way to make rich visual experiences that are very light, kind of like Flash.
Nice. Jeremy Keith actually had a really beautiful blog entry about this. I think today it went up, talking about, you know, how excited he is about, you know, this sort of like resurgence of interest in adaptable, responsive design. And, you know, I think the gauntlet's been thrown down for it. It would be really amazing to see what like a full, you know, what the New York Times could do with something like this, or Flickr just relaunched their photo page, and that's an improvement over what
beautiful.
They had. Yeah, it's incredible. But as he pointed out, you know, it's still a fixed screen resolution, which is not bad in and of itself, but it would be really exciting to see what they could do with something like this. I think that
it seems like what Flickr has basically said is, if you look at Flickr on your iPhone, you're going to go to m.flickr.com and have a mobile experience that's optimized for your phone. And otherwise, you need a big browser, a big window, a big desktop browser. And either of those experiences is going to be optimal. And anything in between is not going to be optimal. And they've made the decision that they don't really care. I'm wondering what it's going to look like on my laptop. I may not enjoy Flickr on my laptop. I love it on my iMac, but I don't know if I'll like it on my laptop.
Yeah. Well, and just to sort of jump to their defense, I mean, they're designing for an audience larger than anything I've ever worked on. So there are probably, you know, economies of scale that they travel in that are just way out of my league. But, you know, that said, it'd be really amazing to sort of see what they could do with something like this. So I think the design as they've got it is incredible. But, you know, maybe some more adaptiveness. It'd be really interesting to see what they could do.
Maybe there's a gig there.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, guys, I think it's about that time. We've got to wrap up. Ethan, thanks so much for being on this show. Where can we learn more about this? Should we go to your A List Apart article? Is that the best starting point for people who want to learn about this technique?
I think right now, yeah, that's probably the best place to start learning about it. Like I said, Jeremy Keith's been blogging about it a little bit. I'm also speaking about this topic at an event apart throughout the remainder of the year, but ALA would be a great place to start.
Great.
Yeah, so it's in issue number...
306, I think.
306.
Issue number 306.
Yeah, 306.
I want to thank all our listeners today. I want to thank Ethan. Always a joy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure. And next week, the low-key stylings of 37 Signals CEO Jason Fried will be here on the Big Web Show. So don't miss that.
Thanks again to my co-host Jeffrey Zeldman and to our guest, Ethan Marcotte. And thanks also to our sponsor, MailChimp.com, for making this show possible. And thanks to you for listening. Now you can directly help support 5x5 and your favorite shows by becoming a member and get a cool t-shirt in the process. Go to members.5x5.tv to learn more. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see you again next week.